There is a rich history of comedy in the Jewish religion and culture. You don't have to pause long to think of some of the jokes and joke tellers over the years. People in the comedy business remind us periodically that comedy often comes from pain, and Jews have felt perhaps more than their share in the world throughout history. But pain is not the only source of Jewish comedy. That is one of the things we learned from Jeremy Dauber in his book, Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. Dr. Dauber is a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University in New York, and the author of several previous books on Jewish literature. Jeremy Dauber, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. Now, this can be dangerous territory, you point out. Jewish humor can be tough to define. How so?
Well, I think that first, you know, you're trying to talk about the history of Jewish comedy. You know, you've got thousands of years of Jewish history. You've got Jews living in a wide variety of areas, multiple continents. There's just such a massive amount of material that to try and make sense of it all, to tell its story or multiple stories even about it, you know, is a bit of a tough task. And even so some limitation had to be in order. So first I had to figure out what makes Jewish comedy. And I said sort of it has to be produced by Jews, and it has to say something meaningful or valuable for the purposes of the book about Jewish existence, Jewish history, Jewish culture, Jewish theology. So that was where I started.
How intertwined are the histories of Jewish and American comedy?
Well, I think that you're right to ask that question. I think, you know, Steve Allen, not a Jew, but a great comedian, estimated that in the second part of the 20th century, at one point, 80% of American comedians were Jewish comedians. So, you know, you couldn't get more intertwined than this. And in some sense, the American comedy became part of Jews understanding their own American story, and Jewish comedy became part of Americans understanding their own story. So deeply intertwined.
So you mentioned already that you narrow the broad scope by two things. It has to be by Jews. It has to be about Jews now or in the past. But even within that realm, you got nearly a 300-page book. So it sounds like there's still a lot of material to work with here.
A lot of material to work with, and of course, you know, a lot of material that just couldn't make it into the book. You know, I've been talking about this, you know, a lot over the last month or two that the book has been out, and people always say, well, what about my favorite comedian? Or you talked about my favorite comedian, but what about my favorite joke? Why didn't you talk about that? And there's just so much, an embarrassment of riches. But there's plenty in the book. I think everybody's going to find something that they know and they love and something that's very new to them as well, and that was what I was hoping I'd be able to accomplish.
That's a real interesting element for me, though, is to look at some of the historical thoughts about Jews and humor, particularly given the context of what you just mentioned, where people say, what about this joke? What about this comedian? I mean, Jews and comedy are considered synonymous in America, in our world today. But I'm looking back at some of the historical statements you have in here where non-Jews often thought of Jews as humorless. I mean, were they wrong, or are Jews just funny at this point in history?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, it's a great way of putting the question. It almost seems like a laugh line that sometimes I get where I say Jews were thought of as not funny, right? But the truth is that for that, a lot of the time was the case, that people would look at Jews who were sort of on the outside. They were a minority in a lot of cultures, sort of in Europe through the history of European, Western Europe. And they said, well, Jews, you know, they missed out on the possibility for being part of Christendom. They missed out on the opportunity to take Jesus as their Savior, so they're kind of metaphysically unhappy, right? They're kind of deeply upset about that and sad and melancholic and sorrowful, and that must, you know, expand to every aspect of their lives. And of course, that wasn't true, right? But that was sort of by looking at Jews as a kind of, you know, mysterious other and a kind of minority. But, you know, in America, you have a very different story where Jews have been, you know, largely speaking, welcomed into American culture, certainly into the precincts of American cultural entertainment, and they've become sort of part of this comic story, and so they have that part of it as well.
I'm sort of struck by that previous statement, though, that the thought was that, darn, they missed out on Jesus, they couldn't be happy.
Yeah, and I think that was, you know, there was a way of saying this was the essential fact about Jews, right? And this is that they were not Christians, essentially. And this was something that, you know, came from kind of a lack of proximity and sort of, you know, a stereotyping, sort of an essentializing of Jews into this one essential quality. And one of the things that I often point out in the book is that in some ways, although this is a very different thing, we often do this to Jewish comedy. We say, well, Jewish comedy is this, right? It is a response to persecution. attribution, or it is a theological statement between sort of God's promise and the facts of the history, or whatever we say, right? But it's, of course, it's all these various things, in the same way that it's very hard to characterize American comedy or French comedy as being any one thing. It's a whole bunch of different things, and I tried to kind of tease out some of those things.
And seven strands of Jewish comedy frame the book. So you have the response to persecution you just mentioned. There's also Jewish comedy as a commentary on Jewish social and communal norms, Jewish comedy as bookish intellectual play, Jewish comedy as vulgar, raunchy, and taboo-breaking, Jewish comedy as ironic and metaphysical observation, Jewish comedy as a documentary of ordinary Jewish life, and finally, Jewish comedy as a reflection of the ambiguous nature of Jewishness itself. But it sounds like a lot of people, and this is a good reason that this is the first of the themes you mentioned, believe that Jewish humor is almost solely a response to persecution.
Yeah, and I think that that is, you know, far and away the most common, not only explanation given by scholars of comedy, by scholars of Jewish studies, right, but also by sort of your average person on the street. You ask someone, well, why are Jews funny? They say, well, you know, they had to be funny. It was their way of dealing with sort of history. And I think that a lot of times that was true. A lot of the greatest Jewish comedy comes from that kind of response to persecution. But, you know, it in its own way kind of also characterizes Jews essentially as sufferers and victims. Even with the best of possible purposes, even with liberal purposes and what have you. And one of the things in the book was saying, well, you know, the truth is that's not always the case, and it's not because out of any special pleading. It's just you look at the history of all the things that Jews said that were funny, that said something about Jewish condition, a lot of it doesn't fall into that category. So, you know, you would want to not exclude that because of your theory, so to speak.
All right, much more to talk about with Jeremy Dauber. He is a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University in New York. He's written several previous books on Jewish literature. His latest is called Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Dauber, and you can join us on the exchange as well by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Dauber and you in a minute 30. Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. A Jew, a Catholic, and a Zoroastrian walk into a corner store. I don't know the rest of it. You'll have to pick it up from there. But we are talking about Jewish comedy with Jeremy Dauber at Columbia University, who's a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture. He's written a book called Jewish Comedy, A Serious History, in which he points out there are actually seven distinct strands, as he can see them, of Jewish comedy. And we're talking comedy generally by Jews and about the Jewish condition or culture. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Jeremy, how far back can you find Jewish comedy?
Well, I think you can find Jewish comedy as far back as there's Jewish writing, which is to say you go all the way back to the beginnings of Jewish literature, which is the Bible. A lot of the stuff that is comic in the Bible, we don't think of as ha-ha, laugh-out-loud funny necessarily, and sometimes doesn't even feel Jewish in the way that we think about sort of our intuitions of what Jewish comedy is, but that also is part of the story. You have prophetic satire. You have the prophets sort of making fun of idol worshippers and pagans. You have people sort of mocking people who don't get with the right side of God's program. There's all this very confident, satiric, mocking comedy. Or there's a kind of irony that's sort of at play in the book that then gets sort of quashed down by God, who says, nope, you're wrong. Irony doesn't work in a world where, we're in a world where I'm in charge. But then, with the destruction of God's temple and the diaspora, which is also at the end of the Bible, you know, things begin to shift a little bit. Jewish conditions become less triumphalist, a little bit more concerned and anxious, and we get to a kind of more black and ironic comedy that seems a little bit more familiar to us. But that's already by the Bible.
I want to ask about the parts of the Bible and some specifics here, but I want to come back to a phrase you mentioned just a moment ago, our intuitions of Jewish comedy. So, I mean, that's a good place to go. I mean, is there something that the world just thinks, well, that's a Jewish joke, and when they do say that, what they would be talking about?
Well, it's an interesting thing. They interviewed, this was about 20 or 30 years ago, they interviewed a lot of television writers for what they thought would be kind of being funny in a Jewish way, right? Someone interviewed them, a scholar interviewed them. And basically what they came up with was putting sort of that a funny kind of Jewishy way of joking would be putting sort of different words, changing the word order, right? So saying, you know, this you tell me, that kind of thing, right? You know, and the truth is that that seems funny to us who are native-born English speakers, but it's a perfectly legitimate and not funny at all way of speaking in Yiddish. Right, so immigrants to Eastern Europe, from Eastern Europe to America, who spoke Yiddish, when they learned English as adults, this is the way they talked. But we, sort of in later generations, have taken that as kind of funny sort of borscht belty kind of comedy. And I think that that's a lot of the way that our intuitions are based, of course, of where we are in the world now, and you know that we think about Yiddish and English rather than Yiddish as Yiddish. And this gets to one of these other intuitions that people have, which is Yiddish is funny. Jewish comedy is funny because it's in Yiddish, and Yiddish is essentially funny. And after even a minute of thinking, you know, well, that's not true. It was the general language of an entire sort of people in Eastern Europe. You know, it was funny, and it was sad, and it was erotic, and it was everything. You know, in the same way that you wouldn't call English a funny language. You'd say, well, sometimes people are funny in English.
Well, I want to come back to Yiddish a bit later, but let's go back to the Bible right now and some specific examples of the kind of stuff you're talking about where there was a certain amount of mocking and then God would set things straight. The book of Esther, you point out in the book, is one clear place where you can see this.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, one of the things about the book of Esther, which is a remarkable work of Jewish literature, and I think of literature in general, is that it is the font, the inspiration of sort of Jewish life in the diaspora. It's about the Jews being a minority culture, right, in a place which is surrounded by hostile and often persecutory individuals and people who are interested in sort of eliminating them. And what that leads to is both kind of the joyous relief, which is the base of a certain kind of comic festivity, when the plan doesn't work, right? There's an old Jewish joke that every Jewish holiday is, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. Right, and so you know you have that, right? But on the other hand,
Happy Hanukkah, by the way.
Right, exactly, right, right, exactly. But at the same token, this is a book that normally we would say, you know, we survived by the grace of God, right? But God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther, and a lot of what happens in a plain reading of the book really could be that the salvation of the Jews occurs really just by coincidence. It's just by a set of chances. And the word for that holiday, the holiday that's celebrated in the book of Esther, the holiday of Purim, is the Hebrew word for lottery or, you know, chance game, right? So you have this sort of anxious, ironic black comedy at the end of saying, oh, well, here's this great salvation, but really it was just a matter of coincidence. It was just and that's our bleak joke. And that's the sort of nervous kind of black beating heart at the base of some kinds of Jewish comedy.
Jewish Comedy, A Serious History is the title of Jeremy Dauber's book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. What raises the question, though, in this sort of, you know, wow, we just managed to escape destruction. I mean, with persecution and even potential slaughter looming, I mean, do you think any culture might display some level of gallows humor?
I think absolutely so. And, you know, one of the things that often people ask me to talk about is Jewish comedy unique, right? Is Jewish comedy unique? And I say that, you know, tautologically, yes. I mean, in some sense, of course, it's unique because it features the particular historical experiences and, you know, and cultural shaping of the Jews, right? But in other levels, I don't make any claims for it to be unique. I think there are a lot of things about Jewish comedy that come from being a minority culture, right, which is not only the Jews, and a subject of persecution, which is not only the Jews, or having a set of central texts that they can sort of play with and make fun of, right? Not only the Jews. So there's a lot of that stuff that the particulars are very unique, but the generalities, right? They take other forms in all sorts of other cultures as well.
So on to the Middle Ages and animal fables and riddle tales. just Jews doing this, or adapted by Jews?
I think that's a great point. Many of these are almost universal stories, but they're adapted by Jews in order to deal with the specifics of their particular condition. And I think a lot of them, you know, there's this noted medieval Jewish scholar, Mel Brooks.
Medieval.
Yeah, right? He's a noted scholar of medieval Jewry. And he says, you know, at one point he says, if they're laughing, how can they bludgeon you to death? Right? And I think that that is one of the things that these fables and these animal fables and these riddle tales are all about. They're saying, look, we're in these positions, right? If we're telling fox fables, we're very common. So you have the fox, he's menaced by the lion, and he says some kind of witty and funny thing that gets him out of trouble. Well, that's a pretty good analog for what the Jews often felt like in the Middle Ages, right? They were sort of small, and they weren't, you know, the powerful ones, but by their wits, they could kind of try their best to get out of a certain set of situations. So it was kind of like a guide for living in a certain way.
Let's hear. Can you tell that story? There's one particular fox one where he feigns some lack of ability here to get himself off the hook.
Yeah. So there, I think I know the one you're talking about, which is that there's a lion who's wandering through the woods, and he's kind of hungry, and he says to one person, you know, how does my breath smell? And the guy says, oh, it smells really sweet. And he says, oh, you're lying, you're a liar, I'm going to eat you up. And he eats this animal up. And then he goes to another animal, and he says, well, how does my breath smell? And he says, oh, it smells terrible, because he saw the other guy, he's not an idiot. And he says, the guy says, oh, how can you insult me? And he eats him up. Right, so it's a no-win situation. And then he gets the fox, he says, well, how does my breath smell? And the fox says, oh, you know, I have a cold. I can't smell anything. So, you know, he gets out of it. And, you know, again, wit gets out of these kind of no-win situations. On the other hand, and I point this out in the book, right, it also reinforces this idea of the fox being sort of weak and defenseless, and I have a cold, right? I'm sick. I'm not healthy and strong like you. And that was a kind of pose that the Jews had to, by virtue of their weakness, they had to continue to adopt. And some people said, well, you know, was that the best thing for the Jews to do at the time? Maybe it was the only thing they could do, but were there consequences to that as well?
So a broader view would be a Jew saying, hey, look, how could I possibly have the kind of power you ascribe to me?
That's exactly right. And I think that gets to one of these, you know, very essential questions, which is this round and round. Humor is something that in many cases was one of the things that the Jews had when they didn't have other things, right? But on the other hand, the kind of suggestive power, right, that the suggested, you know, led to a certain kind of attack towards the Jews. And that was a problem as well.
We are talking to Dr. Jeremy Dauber at Columbia University about his book, Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, to join us by phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. We have a call from Gail in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, it's been about 20 years now, but Isaac Asimov, very famous author,
science fiction writer,
once wrote this doorstopper book of jokes, and I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with that book.
Isaac,
thanks, I'll take my answer off there.
All right, thanks, Gail. Appreciate it. Isaac Asimov with a book of jokes. Is that something you're aware of?
Well, I'm a big Isaac Asimov fan, Gail and Eugene. I mean, I loved reading his science fiction, and I also, as a result, you know, would read a lot of these books of jokes and limericks and all these kinds of things that Isaac Asimov put together. And Asimov was very, you know, he was not an observant or a religious Jew, but he'd certainly made no bones about his Jewish heritage. And so, not surprisingly, he included a number of Jewish jokes in his books. But Asimov, as if you should excuse the expression, was kind of Catholic in his humor. He loved all sorts of different kinds of jokes, one of the things that becomes interesting in that vein was to say which of these jokes are sort of like any kind of jokes, which of these jokes are general jokes that you can sort of swap in a particular Jewish name or what have you, and which of them are very specifically related to the Jewish experience. And that was something, and I have a whole chunk of a chapter on Jewish jokes, and that was something that I tried to look at very closely. What makes a Jewish joke a kind of Jewish joke, right, as opposed to a joke that could have been about anybody but someone puts in Jews?
Are there any required elements?
You know, I think that I don't think there are required elements, but all of these things are judgment calls in a certain way, and they go from easy judgment calls to hard judgment calls about what to include. Like when we started our conversation, the easy ones are about particular stock characters in the Jewish tradition. You know, there are rabbi jokes, right? It's sort of very hard to imagine some of the rabbi jokes about being anything else, but some of them that's not the case, right? For example, you can imagine a lot of jokes about rabbi's sermons. Of being too long, too short, too boring, what have you, right? You could swap out this particular clergy figure and put in another clergy figure without any particular problems. On the other hand, there are jokes about the rabbis writing, as I mentioned in the book, writing a very particular kind of religious document that only occurs in the Jewish tradition. It would be kind of hard to take those jokes and put them in any other kind of tradition. So, you know, I think it depends. There are no required elements, but there are ones that are more or less helpful.
Well, you know, I want to come back to the medieval period for just a second, because there's some fascinating stuff, including a parody from that time, Toledo Yeshu. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that even close to correctly, but fairly daring work, it seems.
I think it is daring work. For those readers, listeners out there who might not know about the Toledo Yeshu, which is not surprising because it's really not that well known, it's what a lot of scholars call a counter history, right? Which is, it's sort of a long tale, which is like almost an alternative history, right? Asimov wrote his own sort of science fiction alternate histories of what might have happened otherwise. And this one is a kind of attack on Christianity. It's an attack on Jesus, right? By telling sort of an alternative historical story about the birth of Jesus and his life, and it is not very pleasant about Jesus, and it is not perhaps surprising considering the anti-Semitism and the persecution that somebody took this and sort of had this kind of aggressive response to it. But of course, that aggressive response was only written in a Jewish language. Because if it had been written in a non-Jewish language, it could have caused a great deal of hostile sentiment and response. So there was, this is the other side of the Mel Brooks sort of equation, right? If they're laughing, how can they bludgeon you to death? But Mel Brooks also says, you know, tragedy is when I cut my finger, comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die. And, you know, I think that kind of comedy is full of hostility and aggression at times. Right. And, you know, this was a way of Jews through comedy trying to get out some of their feelings about the situation that Christendom had put them in that sort of small area. Yeah, the circumscribed area.
And there's another example here, too. It's a great story of an imagined dispute of theology between a Jew and a bishop. Can you tell that one?
Yes, that is, I will tell that, but it's a bit of a long thing. So I'm not sure. Are we okay with the time to tell that story?
Yeah, about 5 minutes to break. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically the way that this story goes is that there is, as Jeffrey's saying, there is a real historical encounter called a disputation, a medieval disputation, where Jews and Catholics would dispute on matters of theology. They would have kind of an argument, a debate. And all of the stakes were on the Jewish side, because if the Christians lost, basically they would agree to keep the status quo. But if the Christians won the debate, then the Jews would have to, either leave the area, or they would have to give up their belongings, or they would have to face some kind of persecution. So these were the stakes of this particular disputation that the joke that I'm telling is about. And the Archbishop challenges the Jews to this debate, and the Jews are everyone does not want to be the representative to face the Archbishop, a fearsome debater in debate. But finally, this one guy, sort of a regular Jew named Yankel, decides, look, we shouldn't just forfeit. I guess I'll do it if nobody else is going to do it. But the problem was that the Archbishop, and Yankel don't share a common language. Yankel doesn't speak Latin, and the Archbishop, of course, doesn't speak Yiddish. So they decide that the debate is going to take place in pantomime, in dumb show. And so they stand there in the middle of the town square, and the Archbishop holds up three fingers. He starts. And then Yankel, without missing a beat, holds up one finger. You know, and the Archbishop starts sweating a little bit. And then the Archbishop points up into the air. And Yankel, again, immediately points down, right at the ground where they're standing. And now the Archbishop is shuddering. And he takes out an apple from his robes. And Yankel, again, immediately, no hesitation, no pause whatsoever, takes out a loaf of bread. And the archbishop says, "That's it, the Jew has won, I forfeit the debate, they've won." And he runs over, and they both run to their separate corners, so to speak. And the archbishop, you know, is surrounded by his fellow clergy, and they say, "What happened? I thought you were such a fearsome debater." And he says, "I was, but this Jew is just amazing. You know, I say first that I start with our three, hold up my three fingers to represent the Trinity, right, which is one of our great pillars of our theology, and he holds up one finger to show that, according to medieval philosophy, you know, what is perfect in essence is finer, and they only believe in one God, and so that's a better theology." And so then I thought that was a very good point, and I said, "But God," and I pointed up, "sent down from heaven his only Son to save us from sin," and he pointed down to the earth and said, "Well, there's no evidence here that we have been saved. Maybe this is your proposition, but we don't see it here." And that was, again, a hard thing to refute. And so I held out the apple, our final major doctrine, that of original sin. And I said that this is an important thing. Look at the fallen state of the earth, if this is what you believe, right? That's proof for original sin. And he held out a loaf of bread, and he said, "No, the truth is that we see that God's love comes out from the ground itself, that is ever loving, ever fructifying. And, you know, you're the religion that talks about love, and so this, by your own terms, should be the proof." And I had nothing else to say about that. And everyone sort of shook their heads, right, at the wisdom of the Jew. Meanwhile, you know, on the other side of the square, they said to Yankel, they said, "You know, Yankel, what happened? How did you do it? How did you do it?
Okay, this is where we have to put a pause in here. We have to get Yankel's answer in just a moment because I want to keep all three of these together. So Jeremy Dauber is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. We will take a short break and come back and listen more to him and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Jeremy Dauber, professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University in New York, the author of Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. And we paused right in the middle of a major story about the disputation in medieval times between the archbishop and Yankel. And the archbishop conceded because he thought Yankel had all the stuff going on as they had their disputation through pantomime because they didn't share a common language. You can join our conversation, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we heard why the archbishop conceded. What did Yankel have to say to his people?
Right, so everyone remembers sort of before the commercial break that it was three fingers and then one finger and then up and then down and then an apple and then a loaf of bread, and there was a whole the whole disputation and debate rested on these matters of theology, right? And so they turned to Yankel and they said, "Well, what happened? The Jews say, what happened to Yankel? What happened? How did you win?" And he said, "Well, you know, the truth is that I really have no idea. I mean, you know, the archbishop said, 'Look, I think we should have three debates.' He held up three fingers, and I said, 'Look, you know, one sounds good to me.' I mean," and then he said, "We should do it over there." And he pointed up to the sky, and I said, "No, look, right here is fine," pointing down. And then we had lunch.
So all Yanka was doing was bringing the bread to compliment the apple.
That's right. And the thing I often say about this joke, which, you know, I think is important to think, is that first, it's a great look at anti-Semitism, because the archbishop, for those of you who are listening for the first part before the break, right, the archbishop makes up all of this stuff, all of his theological concerns and problems about his own religion, about how Jews, it's all in his own head, obviously, right, because Yankel wasn't thinking of any of this. But the second part is that it gets back to this thing that we were saying about the Book of Esther, right, which is that in some sense the Jews were saved by chance, right? It's not that the Jews come out because they victorious because they have a theological superiority or they have great wit or they have anything like that. They just they totally misunderstood what was going on too. And it's that kind of uncertainty that I think is at the heart of a lot of these great Jewish jokes, that there's something slightly anxious and kind of ironic and turned inward about them, too.
Well, and you really kind of brought me up short in this section of the book, too, because you talked about how some pre-modern Jews thought that hating Jews was actually logical for Christians.
Yeah, and I think you can understand, right? I mean, in other words, if you are in a world, right, about which is a theologically motivated world, right, and you say, well, you know, I think that the claims of my theology think that, you know, I am superior and you are inferior, or more precisely, that you think that that this people killed your God, right, and as a result have to suffer, you know, as a result of that, right, they may be wrong, they may be incorrect about the facts, and in fact, they may be, as sometimes was the case with some of these theological statements, they may feel that those beliefs are actually don't seem to make a lot of sense, right, but they're not irrational for pursuing the consequences of those beliefs. And I think that's a point that often gets lost, sort of in looking back at this stuff, right, was, there was this thing of saying, well, they're wrong, but logical.
All right, so yeah, if I felt this way, I'd hate me too. Is
right. Yeah. That's very well put. That's very well, right.
Wow.
I think that's right. And you know, you see this often with the case of converts. Right. There's one of these sort of jokes. The essential jokes in sort of Jewish thinking about converts is that very frequently people don't convert to especially sort of in earlier periods, they don't actually convert out of theological belief. Right, they convert out of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
The reason is because of this sort of sense of theological superiority, saying really nobody would go from our, as Larry David put it much later, no one goes from our team to your team, right? It's like that doesn't happen, really, right? But of course, there were people that was not true. There were people who converted out of theological superiority, out of a sense of theological belief that Christianity was the theologically superior religion. And many of those converts in the Middle Ages, the early modern period, became very avid persecutors of the Jews, right? For exactly kind of the same dynamic that you just mentioned, and that was not funny at all.
Well, no, and you know, there's a lot of not funny in here that is going to come along with when you talk about Jewish history and a serious history of Jewish comedy. I'm still amazed at some of the circumstances in which Jews could still make jokes. I mean, for example, they could contemplate the wiping out of the Yiddish language and its users and still write satire about it. Like, there's a piece in here about the last Jew in Poland that was written in 1935.
That's right. And, you know, and here, of course, it redounds as tragic through the ages that it's written in 1935. Of course, they were seeing the rise of a certain of fascism. They were seeing those things, but of course, they had no idea in 1935 what would become. And yet, somehow, they're able to take this sort of anti-Semitism and they're able to make jokes about it. Sometimes that provided a kind of psychic solace. There were many jokes, during World War II by Jews in occupied Europe about Hitler. Right? I mean, one of my favorites is the one about the two Jews who are sent to assassinate. They have a plan to assassinate Hitler, and they've worked it out all to a T. They've worked it, every single aspect, which involves sort of when his motorcade is going to pass at this particular time. And they're there. They're in wait. They have their tripwires and their bombs, whatever. And they wait, and the motorcade is 1 minute passes. The motorcade's not there. 5 minutes pass. 10 minutes pass. No motorcade. And one of them turns to the other and says, "Boy, I hope nothing happened to him."
Oh, but you point out, right, that even in the camps there was humor about the treatment.
I think, well, there was certainly humor, right? There was humor about sort of, and a lot of it was very black humor. But whatever kinds of jokes we know that were changed, right? Viktor Frankl, who went on to write many books, become a very famous psychotherapist after his logotherapist, after his survival of Auschwitz, said that one of the ways that he managed to maintain a certain kind of equilibrium, psychic equilibrium, was with a friend to help come think of one funny thing a day. And, if that helped them, who are we to kind of make judgments about what is or was not appropriate, right, at the time, or what was unbelievable? It worked for them, and we're very grateful for whatever crumbs of solace that provided.
The ability of people to turn things around, though, and this is not necessarily just a Jewish thing, but boy, it certainly has some impact. You point out that 11 years ago, an Iranian newspaper announced a contest for the best anti-Jewish, anti-Israel cartoons, and there was a great response from one Israeli illustrator.
That's right. And that response wasn't like, well, you know, we're going to make our own anti-Semitic cartoon, you know, our anti-Semitic cartoon contest, right? Who can do it better than us? Right? We'll show them. And I think that some of this was, you know, as we keep cycling back to this particular strand, which is a hugely important one, but of just saying, look, there's nothing often we can do about sort of the mug's game that history has provided for us, right? There's a joke also in the book, right, about after World War One, where Woodrow Wilson is talking to the Polish premier, and he says, look, you know, if we have a good sort of settlement conference, if we don't have a good settlement conference, everybody's going to be so upset that they're going to go out and slaughter all the Jews in Poland. And Wilson says, well, what happens if you do have good terms? He says, oh, well, then they'll be so happy that they'll go out and slaughter all the Jews in Poland.
Ouch.
And, right, ouch, indeed, right? And you sort of say, well, you know, if this is the conditions, if this is the playing field, well, you got to laugh, because what else can you have? If Iran's going to, you know, do this and there's nothing or nobody who's going to stop them, well, you got to, is there a better response than make jokes? And the answer is, of course, for some people, yes, there is a better response, which is to try and make sure that Iran doesn't, you know, do whatever it can do to you know, spread this sort of material. But that's sort of one of the balances about how comedy works, you know, with Jews.
We have one email here from Peter, no town given. He says, I'm making breakfast listening to the program, and the joke about the Jew and the Archbishop caught my attention. I've been telling that joke for years, and it made me so happy to hear someone else tell it. It made my morning. Thank you. I love your show. Stay blessed, Peter.
That's so great to hear. Thank you, Peter. I'm glad you enjoyed the joke, and I'm glad to share it with you. Yes, there are a lot of these jokes, you know, that I tell in the book, you know, different people have come to me and they say, oh, you know, I've heard that joke, but I hadn't heard that one. And it's just, it's really nice to hear that it's a community of people who know and love these jokes.
When you get to this, the second theme, and there are seven here, and obviously we're not going to have time to get to all seven here, of the sources of Jewish comedy. The second one is the satirical gaze at Jewish social and communal norms. And this is where Jon Stewart shows up, which when he was doing the Daily Show. And I don't know. I guess I get to this question of, like, is it Jewish or is it American done by a Jew?
Yeah, and I think that is a really essential question for particularly that strand of Jewish comedy, that satirical strand, because on the one hand, a tremendous number of the individuals who were associated starting with, let's say, the 50s and moving through into the current day were Jews, right? Perhaps the most famous satirist of his generation, Mort Saul, was Jewish, mm-hmm. right? But Saul is very clearly, almost nothing that Saul does, you know, in his work has anything to do with Jewishness. Except, you know, you could argue, right, if you really wanted to, that, you know, his kind of move towards social justice or something like that was a kind of Jewish thing, but that's not the kind of argument that I like to make, because that seems very circular. But then there are other people like Lenny Bruce, who was a satirist, who said, you know, part of his shtick, and I use that word consciously because Bruce loved to put Yiddish into his work, part of the shtick is just being who I am, which is a Yiddishy kind of Jew. And that's part of my satire, is kind of being a kind of Jewish guy who likes to sort of hang out and use his own personal biography and his own personal perspective to kind of make fun of the way the world is. And there you have this entrance of the sort of Jewish autobiographical into it, and that's something that Stewart kind of sometimes does and sometimes doesn't, and that's why he's an interesting test case.
He really is. Let's take a call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeremy Dauber.
Thanks for a very interesting program, gentlemen. I have a question about the diaspora. Is there a difference in humor going way back, I guess hundreds of years, between the Levant, the Mediterranean Jewish peoples as opposed to the Ashkenazi peoples? And then in particularly, I don't know if you've researched this, is when people moved into the Caribbean and Central and South America, Jewish peoples, did we have a development of Jewish humor into the Caribbean and Central and South America? Do we have Jewish comedians in Brazil or Argentina? That's what I would really like to know.
That
Thank
is
you.
A great question. Thank you for that, Connie.
It's a great question, and it's sort of a two-part question, and I'll take both parts. The first is there a difference between what often is considered the great sort of central division in Jewry between Jews of kind of European, Western, Eastern European descent, the Ashkenazic Jews, and Jews of kind of the Mediterranean, Levant, North Africa, what have you, all the Sephardic, and sort of Spain and Iberia, the Sephardic Jewry. And I will say first that Sephardic Jewry has a long and very distinguished tradition of comedy, both what one might call, elite comedy, high comedy, particularly in the kind of poetry, the very linguistically complex poetry of the Golden Age of Spain, which is very funny, but sometimes you have to know a lot in order to get it, into kind of folk humor that's in Judeo-Spanish and some of this other material. So there's a lot of great both high and low comedy there. The interest from the Caribbean and sort of the South America, Brazil, what have you, is also very interesting. Brazil, Argentina. I have to confess, it is not an area that I spent a lot of time focusing on, but what's one of the things that's of interest to me as a Yiddish professor is that many of the individuals there who are in some of those countries were emigrated from Eastern Europe. So not all of them were Sephardic Jews. Some of them were Ashkenazic Jews as well. And what that led to was at various points on the Pampas and places like that, you have these Jewish cowboys. And one of the things I talk about is this question of, is it incongruous and therefore funny, right, because incongruity is a big basis of comedy, to be kind of Jewish cowboys? Does that phrase, which may, again, intuitively bring a smile to our faces, is that funny? And if it is, why is it funny? What is it about Jewishness that seems not to accommodate cowboyhood or knighthood in a couple of centuries back? And that's one of the things I talk about in this final chapter.
Before we go, I want to get to the bookish, witty, intellectually elusive play, the story of two Jews coming up on boulders blocking their path. Can we get that one in before we go?
Sure, yeah, that's a great joke. It's one of my favorites. So, you know, you see these two Jews, they're walking along, right, and they see this rock that is blocking their path, and they can't go anywhere. And so they're stuck, and they say they don't know what to do, and all of a sudden this non-Jew sort of comes up, and he sees the rocks, and he sort of puts his shoulder to them, and he grunts, and he strains, and he pushes them aside, and he goes on his way. And the Jews look at each other and say, well, that's the Gentile for you. You know, that's the guy for you. Always with the force. Right? And I think that's a great, because again, it's this sort of circular sort of twisting in on itself. On the one hand, you know, here's this kind of superiority of saying, well, we are people of the mind. We don't, you know, the force. But of course, force is the only way of dealing with this problem. And so they would have been happy to sit there and sort of pretend that, you know, argue about sort of the theological essence of the rock until the cows came home. You know?
That is a wonderful joke. And we didn't mention a great number of names here. I want to point out Larry David gets a fairly long section. Mel Brooks, of course. Woody Allen, Rodney Dangerfield, Jack Benny, Jerry Seinfeld, of course. All in the book, Jewish Comedy, A Serious History. Jeremy Dauber wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Jeremy, thank you so much.
A real pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
All right, take care.